Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 57. Today we hear from Michael Adam, Architect and Manager with Red Hat, as he presents SMB3 in Samba, Multi-Channel and Beyond, from the 2016 Storage Developer Conference.
My name is Michael Adam. I'm a Samba developer since quite a couple of years by now. I'm working for Red Hat in the Red Hat storage server segment. So there we are working on Samba and related technologies, Samba on top of distributed scale-out storage solutions like GlustFS and Ceph, but also quite generally Samba development. What I'm presenting on here is more a view of the Samba upstream community, which to a large extent reflects what I and my colleagues are working on, so there's a certain overlap, but it's my personal presentation, my personal view of things mostly, so nothing politically imposed by my employer here. But since he's sponsoring me to be here, I think it's fair to list it. So this is about the status. So what about SMB3 and Samba generally, and
specifically addressing the multi-channel feature which we have been working on, and what's next.
So last year I gave a presentation about multi-channel in Samba at this conference, and so let's see what has changed.
What's the agenda of the talk?
So at first, a little bit of the overview. What features of SMB2 and newer are there in Samba? What's their state? Then a longer section about the state of multi-channel. Then outlooks on a couple of interesting bigger features of SMB3 that we are currently working on in Samba. As my previous speakers, please interrupt for any questions during the talk. I'm happy to have it interactive. Okay, so let's have a bigger list. SMB2, starting with SMB2.0. I mean, SMB2.0 was first features in Samba 3.6 as experimental, and was made fully supported in Samba 4.0 in 2012. And this is when we also closed the biggest gap there to add the support for durable file handles. And all these other things which are flagged here, 4.0, and stuff, was there the same way last year. The new thing is multi-channel. Last year, I presented on a work in progress proof of concept kind of thing. The main achievement since last year is most of the code has been stabilized into the upstream code base. It has made it into 4.4, which was released in spring this year as an experimental feature. I'll detail on why it's experimental. This is the red one, and the blue ones are the other parts that have been listed in the agenda. Things we are working on that are not complete, that are not yet upstream in Samba, but are important pieces of the SMB3 protocol suite. On the other addition here, the change is that leases, SMB2 leases, the SMB2 flavor of or improved variant of OpLox, has been added to 4.2 a couple of years ago, but it has been made the default to on to support it in the very recent release of 4.5 Samba, which was released this month. So that's just a change. We made some feature turned on by default. Okay, so that's the overview. Now let's go on to multi-channel. So just briefly recapping, so a couple of the slides people may recognize from last year. What is it? It is the feature in the SMB protocol version 3 and newer to bind multiple transport connection into a single SMB session in an authenticated context in order to allow for greater throughput and also failure safety. So that when you have multiple
connections in your session, one fails, the complete session is still intact. Clients do not need to reconnect and reestablish a session until the last of the channels in the connect or in a session goes away. And also, clients, this is as it is with many features in SMB. The server merely presents the core functionality, the logic, how to use it is in the client. So the Windows client will send IOs over all available channels, at least over those of the best and the highest quality, basically, the fastest channels. So if you have a couple of 10 gigabyte or gigabyte interfaces, client will use them all and thereby create a bigger throughput. So these are the main basic thoughts of multi-channel. How does it work from a protocol perspective? Not referring to any implementation. So the client, of course, there's always a first session for the first connection for a session. This is just as it was before, and then through that session, the client there's a special new ioctl in SMB3, the query network interface info ioctl, which the client sends to get the information about all the available interfaces on the server, along with their speeds and various other characteristics. It then can choose to bind additional TCP or later RDMA connections as so-called channels to the already established SMB3 session. So that's a new flavor of the so-called session setup. Request says, okay, here's my stuff, and I please add it to this session, specifying the session ID of the existing session, and that requests the server to bind this connection over which this session setup request comes into the server to bind this connection to the existing session instead of establishing a new session. So that's the session bind request, or the binding flavor of the session setup request. So Windows clients do is Windows clients bind multiple connections into a session, even of different quality, but then it uses them for IO only usually the highest quality. So if you have like 5 1 gigabit interfaces and 1 10 gigabit interface, it will only use the 10 gigabit interface. Only if that fails, it will fall back to using ideally 5 1 gigabit interfaces. Similarly, if there is one InfiniBand interface and the server is capable of supporting RDMA as a transport, this SMB direct flavor, it will usually only use that RDMA interface. But these are client details. It's not necessary to behave like that. That's client specific. That's just how Windows behaves. And if there's a cluster, SMB3 is supporting some clustering. Windows will only bind connections from a single node. It will multi-channel sessions does not span multiple nodes. That's also something Windows does. And in order to protect the data integrity, there are a couple of replay, retry mechanisms. There are some, I call it epoch numbers. I think that was the old term. They are called channel sequence numbers in order to detect channel failure and do the correct things. Like a packet is sent over one interface of a session, one channel of a session, and that channel fails before the client has received the answer back from the server. So what does it do? It resends the same request on another channel with a flag saying this is a replay thing, and the server then it chooses. Either it has already received the request and has already, for instance, created the file, if it was a create request, and then chooses to say, yeah, okay, I already created it, but I'm not replying on another channel because the reply that I sent out earlier over the first channel didn't arrive at the client. Something like that. These mechanisms, there's a lot of details to be done here. So that's how the protocol works in general. The main thing is there a question?
Yes, if this is connected, is it all over a physical interface, or can it be two TCP connections on the same?
It can be two TCP on the same interface. That makes sense if the interfaces on the server are receive side scaling capable, for instance. So that's also one of the aspects of the interfaces that this network interface call gives back to the server, to the client.
Can the server round robin on the responses? In the sense, I have 5 connections which are same in terms of?
Usually, no, the server usually sends back the response on the same channel where the request came in. So the client spreads the load. The server, yeah.
You can pull the request and send it out the response on the other interface. Not in case of failure, but as a roundup.
No, that's not what's happening, at least. So the question was, does the server round robin, receiving a request on one channel, sending a response on another? That's not what's happening.
But in theory, there's nothing that stops us.
Since this is happening on I don't know, maybe David has the latest details.
There'd be a few issues with that, one of which is sequence numbers are per channel, and title sequence numbers are signing, and the signing keys are different per channel, so they can replay things. So if you allow that, the messages will switch signing keys partway through, so it's not supported.
Yeah.
The only exception would be if you get a lease break. A lease break can arrive on any channel that's associated with the problem.
Right. I will come back to lease breaks. So the answer was mostly due to the signing mechanisms. Each channel in a session has its own signing keys associated, and so the reply has to come on the same channel. So lease breaks are different. I'll address lease breaks later because that's one of the things we're still working on. Oh yes, Richard.
Yeah. So can we clarify that? Is it each message has its own sequence number or its own message ID?
Message ID is there is the so-called channel sequence number, which is in the requests, the channel sequence number is bumped when there is a failure of a channel, so the server and client can detect that there was a problem, and then client logic can try to resend the request on another channel. I think that's the basics of it, right?
I used the wrong term. I should have said message ID. Sorry.
Ah, okay.
Like message IDs are for a channel, but the sequence numbers are exactly what you said.
Yeah.
So okay. The sequence numbers are the same.
No, message ID is different from sequence number. And okay, that's good. Interesting points. Let's. Yeah. Okay. One more question.
As for the comments coming in from the different channels, dependency.
No. The client can just send IOs, for instance, opening a file and then send IOs read write requests to that file over different channels completely independently. And with the Windows client being like multi-threaded, this is happening more or less in parallel.
The server can respond. It's independent of the server.
Yeah. Right. So that's true. It will still usually respond in the order as the requests come into the server and then respond over the various channels. But
there's always an extra channel.
Well, that's actually, the ordering on from the server is per channel for sure, and otherwise it's also a little bit an implementation detail. So let's look in how we try to implement this in Samba, right? Samba has a certain peculiarity in its design when it comes to comparison with other servers. So Samba is a multi-process architecture. So what does it mean? There is usually a one-to-one correspondence between TCP connections and child processes of the main SMBD server daemon. So that means servers there, a new connection request comes in, and Samba forks a new SMBD child request, child process, which is then responsible for serving that single TCP connection. And so that has many, many advantages. And in the area of, let's say, cloud and Go language and memory doesn't cost anything. I mean, the main disadvantage is usually memory consumption, which is, not so important anymore as it was a couple of years ago. And one of the advantages is, for instance, if there's a crash bug, only one connection, only one client is affected usually, not the whole server. So it had many, many advantages. So here it presents us with a couple of challenges. So how do we do that, right? We have one connection with the session associated, and another connection comes in. Look at this. The client is here. Here's the Samba server. First channel is already there. And a second connection comes in, which is then a second SMBD daemon. And it would
actually create a multi-channel session, and these SMBDs, they would have to synchronize for disk access and all that kind of stuff. Different processes, way more difficult than for threads of the same process. So we want to avoid that synchronization between the SMBD processes. We don't want to do that in Sambal. We actually want one process to serve all channels of a session. So the idea is just transfer the new TCP connection to the existing SMBD. So new TCP connection comes in, we pass the connection over, and then we have a multi-channel session in that SMBD, the other can just go away. That was the basic idea. So how to do it? There is a method, the call called send message, receive message, pair of calls, which are capable of passing open file descriptors from one process to another. It's called FD passing. That could be used. What's the right time? I mean, the protocol choice would be at session setup and the bind request. Samba chose to use the first request in a connection, the negotiate request, because then we already have the client GUID, which is always there in SMB 2.1 or newer, and based on that, we find the SMBD responsible for the client GUID and pass the request over. That's better because this is basically the first thing that happens on the connection, and so there's not much additional state that we need to pass. We just need the notify request, pass it over, and the receiving SMB daemon responds to that. And it binds it to the session in there. So that was our choice because it's easiest and least error-prone approach here. And we are sacrificing a little bit of granularity. So if the same client does a new session and does not do a bind request afterwards, it will still be served by the same server if this is enabled. Question?
How do you identify the first SMBD that came in?
Yeah, we are. So all the changes we did in Samba, they introduce basically a new database internally, which indexes the Samba daemons by the client GUID. So we can look the client GUID up there and say, okay, what's the server process ID and whatever serving this client GUID, and we just use that as a target. Samba, yeah. So that's the basic idea. So there is this diagram some people have probably seen. So how does it work? Client connects, TCP connect. Main SMBD forks the child number one. We have negotiate, we have session setup, and some other stuff. Then a second connection is done. We fork a second child, and the negotiate request will find the client GUID, find that child one is already serving this client, pass the socket over, and then go away. And then the reply of the negotiate request will come from this child one. And then the session bind request will already end up here, and from here on, everything is done from child one. So that's the flow of things. Uri has a question.
Client GUID, is it if you have two connections from the same Windows client, let's say you use two DNS names or whatever, do each of them have its own client GUID, or they use the same?
Yeah, so that was the question is, do connectors from the same client machine have the same client GUID, basically? So usually, yes. And if the client wants to bind to the existing session, then for sure is at least, I mean, this is not in the documents, but it's at least what our friends from Microsoft told us after we had discussed these things for quite some time.
So, actually asking for, let's say, testing purposes when one simulates multiple clients using a single machine, then using the new architectures, they will end up on the same.
Could be, yeah. So we only care, of course, about the case, I mean, really care about the case in the server when the client GUID is, when we are expecting a session bind, right? And so if you're using testing and you're using one client machine to do a lot of different stuff that you expect to end up in multiple processes, then this may really end up in one. Yeah. So was there a comment about this? Okay. Right. So yeah, there is a certain trade-off here. True. But the simplicity of solution is actually good. And one thing I can just jump forward a little without going to the slide. So there's of course a concern. Yeah, some small single multi-process, and so one. So we know I have just one process serving that same all.
all those connections, doesn't that suck performance-wise? The point is that for the really important things like these IOs, read and writes over the network, to the disk, we use threads. And so we are using a combination nowadays of multi-process, the main process, the main thread in the process for tracking the connection, but for reads and writes and all that stuff, we're using short-lived helper threads. So we are actually using multiple CPUs for that if you have multiple clients going to that process. So just to prevent these kinds of questions. Okay, so, it's already there. I didn't even jump so much forward. I have also had, we don't have extensive benchmark yet. These are still to be done, but here are some numbers I got somebody, it's not linear. It's not like add a channel and you get like double the performance. We're not there yet, but we're getting roughly 50% on top. So that's already quite good. And having big IOs through the two channels of, what were those? I was hearing like 800 megabytes for a single channel and some 1300 megabytes per second on the two channel session. Steve?
So the case Microsoft used to talk about early on, I don't know if they still do, was one adapter with the newer RSS capable adapters, and it looks like a few of the adapters in my house are RSS capable, but most aren't. But yeah. If you had an RSS capable adapter, do you see any improvement in two channels, one adapter?
You should. But I do need to do some homework there. So the problem is that I really need to test with some real hardware to
this virtualization, I couldn't test.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So the question was, RSS capable network on the server, do we see the real benefit there? I think we should if the server is beefy enough, basically, right? But I haven't tested it really in real hardware. So it needs to be proven. Okay. So, what's the status in Samba really? I was talking very generally. So where are we? I was mentioning that we have it as experimental feature in 4.4. And from the numbers in the first update slide, you could tell that it's not changed in Samba 4.5, despite that was the intention to make it, to bring all the missing bits into Samba 4.5 and make it fully supported. That kind of didn't work out fully. There were other distractions that prevented us from making the big, same progress, the actual progress that we wanted. But yeah, I mean, that's what it is. So where are we? So the prerequisites, messaging rewrite, was done as early as Samba 4.2 and also the FD passing capability in our messaging infrastructure. Messaging is used to pass this, communication between the SMBTs here, basically. And then there were a lot of these patches that we are presenting on the work in progress stuff last year, but it has all most of that stuff has made it into 4.4. So that was a quite major effort on polishing the patches, making sure they really work. So the internal structures had to be reworked. We had to prepare the code in the single daemon to cope with multiple connections. We had implemented the message in SMBD to really pass the TCP socket with the negotiate blob on it. We have implemented the session bind. We have implemented the channel epoch numbers or the channel sequence numbers with the associated checks. We have implemented this interface discovery thing. So this can be done. And when Linux supports it, we're using the EDH tool applicable to the kernel to detect the interfaces really and the speeds. If this is not available, you can still override it by config and say, hey, this is a, 10 gigabit interface or something. So that's there. What's missing? This is all there. So that's why we could call it supported in experimental in 4.4. Steve, a question?
I remember we had discussions sometime about other ways of detecting whether the adapter was fast enough to be like that RSS flag that you display that says, hey, can you offload on a fast adapter? Does that IOPTL that you're talking about allow you to return enough information to populate the interface discovery, including that RSS flag?
The question is, does this IOPTL give enough information about the interface to fill that? So there is not so much information. It is the speed. Is it an RDMA cable interface? And it is an RSS cable interface. So these are the three things. So RDMA we don't support yet. And RSS capable can be told from ETH tool, it's not implemented yet in Samba. And speed? Yeah. So this is the ETH tool we all know. I mean, if you're working on Linux and network environment, and this is called is using an octal to the Linux kernel to tell these things. And yeah, we kind of figured it out. So what's missing? So implementing test cases, well, that's always work in progress, of course. There are a lot of pending test cases we have not pushed yet, because the next point, our test infrastructure, the so-called socket wrapper, is not capable of doing FD passing yet. That's one of the tasks. This work in progress, a colleague and of mine and I am basically working on it based on ideas from Stefan Metzmacher and myself from our previous discussions here. Then this very important thing, the least break replay that was mentioned, this is work in progress. Günther, Metz and I are working on it basically. With Metz is here kind of consulting and advising us, because he had some ideas about it when we initially planned on this. And one thing is, one challenge is the integration of the multi-channel with clustering. There are certain additional challenges here. So I want to address the three items here in the next couple of slides, because these are the open to-dos that we are currently working on. So the first thing, socket wrapper, self-test. Samba development is very much driven by our self-test, so everything that lands in the upstream repository needs to pass our self-test, which runs for, I don't know, 3 hours currently, and does a lot of very individual, very detailed protocol-level tests, but bigger integration tests also. And of course, if you can't test a feature there, it's not safe of regression, so we need to have it tested in our self-test. Problem is, and this self-test is not like many CI infrastructures these days. It's not spinning up big VMs or even containers. It's very, very general. We are using so-called wrappers that intercept many system calls, like the socket wrapper intercepting network calls, resolve wrapper intercepting DNS resolution calls, and all that kind of stuff to fake an environment which feels to the Samba server as if it's running as root. In fact, it's not. It can be executed as an arbitrary user, and it fakes stuff. For instance, the sockets are, so this is with the LD preload mechanism. It intercepts, for instance, the socket and connect and whatever calls, and instead of doing a real TCP connection, it turns that into a Unix domain socket connection, and it keeps all the metadata about the TCP connection in an additional data store. So that's really, really convenient. It's very portable, runs on many Unix systems, in contrast to all those virtualization and container systems. So it's super convenient. It's very old. We are using this since many, many years. It's very proven. But it's lacking the feature of FD passing in the send message, receive message call. So what to do about it? And as I said, this is we've gone quite far already. I hope to be able to complete this very soon. So first, the internal structures need to be untangled. That's done. So the point is, what we need to do is we need to make it possible to share the socket metadata information between a couple of processes here. Originally, this socket infrastructure was just this list. I mean, we actually do have a Unix domain socket, but we have this kind of addresses and capture information, all that kind of stuff is in this so-called socket infrastructure. We had, the current code has a linked list of it that's dynamically extended and shrunk when there are new sockets are created or deleted, so closed. That can't work between processes, so we are creating an array of fixed length area of sockets, socket infrastructures that we are putting into that we want to put into shared storage between the processes. We also need to protect the structures from concurrent access, using just as we're doing in TDB. We are using process shared robust pthread mutexes for that, and then we're putting this list and the free list kind of tracking, putting that into a shared memory between the processes to be implemented. Also here, stemming from the ideas from TDB, we're going to use a file and memory map that into each of the using processes. And so we have a very, very simple structure here. Once we have that, I mean, we can implement FD passing by, how does it work? The send message call gets an array of FDs. We're just creating an additional file, which is a pipe between the processes. We're passing one end over, and we are sending the receiving process over that file after it has received the call. We are writing into the pipe the information, an array corresponding to the FD list, an array naming the index in the area of socket infrastructures, one for each. So here's the FD. We're sending the index into the socket infrastructure over there. And the receiver reads this and builds up its new connections between the FD and the socket infrastructure and bumps the ref counter in the shared socket infrastructures. So, because after a send message call, in order to implement it correctly, both the sender and the receiver can, in theory, work on the same socket just after a dupe call. It's very similar, just because between processes. And so, while we in Samba usually close the FD after we send it away, this is not necessary. And since this is a general purpose testing tool, we need to implement it correctly. So that's the design. And currently, we are somewhere here in the implementation. So we are currently making these thread tape preparations, already looking for this, and afterwards we can implement this FD passing. So it is. I was going into a little bit of detail because I think it's a very interesting piece of work. It's a lot of fun, and these wrappers, yeah, they are very useful. People start using that for testing Kerberos, for testing PAM, for testing all sorts of things. Okay, so that was this bit. The next, the big thing, basically, the least break replay. So, what's so special about that? Usually what happens in SMB, a client sends a request, server thinks about it and sends back a response. These or op-lock breaks are the only case where the server sends something unasked to the client. And hence all the protection mechanisms with the channel sequence number don't apply. This is completely different. The logic here is in the server, not in the client. And so this is the fundamental difference. So what we need to do is, we need to, the document just says, yeah, if the channel fails and the client, the server doesn't get reply back for that least break, you should try to send it again on a different channel, if there is a different channel. And only once it has tested all channels and all have failed, then it will declare this client not to be available anymore. The problem is, this is really, really dangerous, so it's critical to have this. If we don't implement this correctly, but just say, hey, it doesn't respond, there's a timeout, okay, we think the lease break has been acknowledged. That means, so when do these lease breaks happen? Client has a file open. Another client wants to open the same file. Server says, hey, give back your caches. You have unwritten data there. And if it just ignores that and gives back the open to the new client, data corruption can happen because two clients think they are exclusive on the file, for instance. So this is totally crucial because this is not implemented yet in Samba. We had to declare it experimental. So multi-channel will, in Samba 4.4, is experimental because it will eat your data under some certain race conditions. So don't use it in production yet, please. Or don't blame us if you do. And so that's so important. We need to track the health of the connections here. We need to track what kind of lease breaks we have sent and we have not received an ACK for. So how do we do it? We have already a send queue in our internal structures. We added an ACK queue. We're using the IOCTL, the SIOCOUT queue. Basically, it's the unsent data, the unsent number of bytes on that socket. It's an IOCTL to the socket FD. We're using that. Yeah, this is the stuff that has been given to the kernel, and that the kernel. It has not sent them, or it has not received an ACK. So there's another
difference. So an ACK number.
Right, and so I have not managed to make a more pretty picture. So this is the ASCII art where I kind of visualized what's happening, what we are doing here. So this is, imagine, these are P1, packet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in that send queue. These are not only, this may not only be lease breaks, but also other packages on the client, on the queue. So what we're doing here, this is, we are tracking for each I/O, for each packet we send on the wire, we are increasing the send bytes counter. This is here. And then we are reading, for each I/O, we are reading the this queue counter from the ioctl. And so this will be subtracted from here. So we end here. We know, this number here at the front, up to here we have act, we have it act, these bytes. So it means this packet has been fully act. Oh, we track this one as an as a least break packet in our act queue. So this can be crossed away. This has been successfully sent to the server. So the next one is not an act packet, not a least break packet, so we can basically ignore it. But this one is not even completely out. This one here is again an ACK packet. So this we know has not been ACKed by, it has not reached the client, or the client has not confirmed back. So we only remove that from the ACK queue, and even this is not fully sent yet. So this is how we do our calculation for detecting which packets have been ACKed and which haven't been ACKed. So this is a little tricky. The point is, we could also use sequence numbers and stuff, but the point is, this ioctl is completely portable in the Unix world. It's a big advantage. And this the algorithm that I described here, it is precise. At some point when the queue is completely empty, we can, for instance, reset the counters to zero, because otherwise you will be increasing them over and over again. But so that it seems a little bit awkward. Basically, it was Metz's idea when we discussed this stuff, and I had to think a lot, quite a bit about it, but I think it's a good thing. So this is what is currently been implemented. And so when we have that, there's this mechanism that we are also implementing based on that. So what will happen is, if this packet stays unacked until a timer expires, then we will declare the channel dead and resend the X over the least breaks over different channels. So it's also a timer, of course, involved with that. That's what's going to happen here. So there's the code. The latest changes are in Günther's Git, but this has the same state. So this is the branch where I originally tracked these the work in progress patches, and currently these are in sync. So this is where we kind of exchange our patches. It can all be observed there. There's nothing secret about it. It's open source. Yay! Okay, that's about the least break. So that's the most critical piece, apart from self-testing, which is, of course, crucial for conceptual reasons. But this is really the dangerous bit. And now integration with clustering is also important. There are some special considerations, as I said. Channels of one session should only be to one node. So we in CDP, so the problem is, there's clustering in SMB3, which we haven't implemented completely yet. But there's, the predecessor of that SMB3 clustering in the protocol is CDP's clustering, which is completely invisible to Windows clients. So they don't know they're talking to a cluster, and so they will they'll try to get there. So we need to, on the one hand side, we need to make a distinction between CDB's public IPs, which can move between cluster nodes and fail over and fail back and so on. So for instance, one possible solution here is, and we are still working out on what's really feasible, what's practical for the real use, to add static IPs to each node, and in the network interface, the ioctl never reply with the volatile, with these floating IP addresses, but just use the static ones. That complicates the setup of the CDB cluster a bit, but it may be the right thing. So this is not completely thought through yet. It's still in progress. And we have in Red Hat, we have a couple of people who are testing this kind of stuff, trying to come up with and QE people. We're really testing a lot of scenarios here, and so something is going to happen about this in the next few months, but I'm not sure how the final solution will really look like. Eventually, when we have the witness service implemented and we are doing real SMB clustering, we'll not have the problem anymore, so we can move that a lot of responsibilities away from CDDB. It will be much easier to implement it there. But with CDDB, which is so convenient because it's easy to set up and it's transparent, it doesn't work. It even works with SMB 1 and 2, not only with SMB 3, so we want it to be supported there. of course, as well. But this is not so. Even in the cluster, you have to be careful. Okay, that was about multi-channel. I think I'm almost out of time, so a little bit. SMB Direct is SMB3 over RDMA as a transport. So it is using multi-channel, so first connection to a TCP connection, and then an RDMA connection is added, and for the RDMA transport, there's a really small wrapper protocol. This is called SMB Direct. And the reason writes are really done through proper RDMA calls to reduce the latency. And so there is not much, but a little bit progress. So. There is an infrastructure sector since quite some time. Multi-channel is I call it essentially done here, so the foundations are laid. There are work in progress things since quite some time already for the transport abstractions. So we have the problem, we can't treat it the same way as we treat TCP connections due to our forking model. FD passing and forking is not really supported by these RDMA libraries. It also kind of contradicts some of the basic thoughts about how RDMA works. And so the idea is to have one central RDMA proxy, let's say, instance. Just for the fun of it, I call it here SMBDD, which will most certainly not be the ultimate name. And so this could be, so it's a central instance sitting there and listening on RDMA and checking basically connections there, and then SMBD is proxying stuff through that. And this, at least for proof of concept and for rapid development turnaround, could very well be a user space daemon. But in production, it will most certainly be a kernel module in order to remove round trips and all that kind of stuff to be much, much faster. And so Richard Sharp, who is over there? Richard has at some point started to hack on a kernel module which implements some of these thoughts. And recently, Ralf Böhme has picked that up. And so there is some code to be seen here. I don't think there is a full, let's say, demo for this yet. So the integration in Samba is also missing. But the important part is to have this kind of proxy. So how does it look like? Remember the slide how a multi-channel works in Samba these days. This is how it roughly could work with RDMA. So the beginning is very, very similar. We connect, get a catch-out process, negotiate, set this up. And now we get an RDMA connection. This ends up in this proxy daemon because it listens on RDMA. And so this creates a socket used for communication, passes that on to the main SMB daemon, that forks just as it forks for any sockets, creates a child, and the negotiate request ends up here. The negotiate has the... wait, how does that work? I'm confused. So the proxy, FD proxy, I'm sorry. Bum, 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 bum. Oh, yeah, this is here. Essentially, the negotiate requests is sent over here. This one looks from the negotiate request, it looks for the client GUID, finds the client GUID here in child number one, passes over the proxy FD and the negotiate request, and the negotiate reply, because it was wrapped in RDMA, it's sent over to the daemon and then sent back here. So and for the actual reason writes, a shared memory area has to be established, and so that these RDMA read and write requests are really proxied through this, and via the shared memory area, they end up in this child one. And so this is the rough idea how this should work. The code that can be seen on GitHub is roughly the implementation of beginnings of this here, but the whole communication between this proxy daemon and the SMBDs, this has to be done. So this is the rough idea of how it could work. Still needs to be proven. Okay, very brief. No. I think Volker will talk about persistent handles later.
No, not really.
Not really. So yeah, I also not really talking. So persistent handles, what's that? That's a totally magnificent. I think it's the holy grail of SME3. Everybody's asking, I want to have persistent handles. I mean, these are like durable handles where a client can be disconnected and can reconnect to the server and get back all this open file handles with their state and locks and caches associated to them, but with guarantees. So it's not a best effort concept, but it's with strong guarantees. The problem is, so the protocol is very easy to implement because we have durable handles. It's just a couple of other flags, and there are work in progress or like proof of concept patches have been around for many years. Recently, there have been extended patches by some contributors on the mailing list. But this is also mainly touching the protocol head and making these working protocols.
The easy part.
That's the easy part. The hard part are the guarantees, because we need to persist the metadata that we are as Samba storing, and currently storing in volatile databases that will just go away if the server goes away. For persistent handles, in theory, a whole server reboot, if it reboots fast enough, needs to be survived, and so we really need to persist the data. So we can't use all fully persistent databases. This is just too expensive. I mean, we could make these databases persistent for a very high performance cost, but so we need to have some way of persisting the information. So there are two general strategies: make it file system specific, which I dislike because can't be tested some upstream generically. Every real productive solution may end up doing a file system specific implementation afterwards, but first we need a generic one with our databases, with TDB and CDDB extensions, essentially making an intermediate model between the volatile databases, the clear first ones, and the persistent databases where we have kind of a per record persistence model. This is something we already discussed last year at Samba XP with Amitay from CDDB, and there are some thoughts, but a lot of devils in the details. So this is the hard part, which needs to be done. But let me say that this will be one of the next things after multi-channel that I and my team will try to get forward on. So that's this one. Witness and clustering is the foundation or the basis for the clustering feature in SMB3. It's there. It's an agent. The client can register for notifications of availability and unavailability of certain shares and IPs on the cluster. So it is a DC-RPC service. It's meant to provide faster failover for clients in the cluster, in contrast to CDB Sticklex, which are also achieving fast failover of clients, which are very implicit. These are explicit. They are rooted in the protocol, of course, a big advantage. What's there in Samba? And there's a development. So Günther and Jose have worked on that. So there's a working proof of concept. There's a working prototype. But there's a very important thing. With the DC-RPC infrastructure, we need to have asynchronous calls, because these are long-lived calls where the client sends a witness request, and just after a certain time, it either gets a timeout or a response that some resources become unavailable or available. So this is a must-have for making this production ready. So you can see it in Günther's work in progress branch. He has demoed this with Jose last year here, I think, already, and they have worked quite a bit on it since then. But so there is stuff to be seen. But this thing is going to be a tech next. Async DC RPC is not only important for witness, but it's important for many other things in Samba. So this is one of the key things that we need to attack him. Wrap me up, what's going to happen? Multi-channel, these finishing moves are going to land in the near future. So for Samba 4.6, which is going to be released in spring next year, like March time frame, this should be done. Witness is going to be worked on. The basic blocking factor here, the roadblock, is async RPC, which we just need Metz to do, or somebody else needs to do it. I mean, and Metz needs to stop complaining, so he's not here. here, so he can't complain now. And then persistent handles, continuous availability, asymmetry of RDMA, which is arguably a little more difficult because it requires, usually requires hardware for testing, especially with Windows clients. And other topics, multi-protocol access is something that we are also working on to some extent, but in this case specific with the Gluster backend for the Gluster storage scale-out solution. And SMB2 and newer Unix extensions have been of increasing interest recently. So Jeremy has talked about this earlier. This is also very important and a good thing, because if we manage to land this, we can really claim that SMB is really the good, the other solution for the multi-protocol access. I mean, multi-protocol access, what is this? It tries to solve the heterogeneous client environment problem, where Linux, Windows, Apple clients all try to access the same data. And multi-protocol is the approach for that problem, where each client should use its own native protocol. And once we have Unix extensions, we can say, yeah, just use SMB. Just use the Linux client, use Apple's client, use Windows client, and they all will be happily using the same protocol with the same server instead of multiple different servers needing to coordinate. So, until we have Unix extension SMB2, we can only use SMB1, and that's not what people want. For instance, also, I think the Apple clients use SMB if it's version 2 or 2.1 and newer. So we need that. And that was my talk so far. Down here is the Git repository for the slides. So because I like this plain text thing, I always use this LaTeX to Beamer stuff. And it's really good. So, and thanks to Mats, who is not here, we have been collaborating on this set of slides. And he has done the artwork of integrating the SNIA kind of theme into this. Very cool. And it's open. You can just steal it. So I think we don't have time for questions. Please feel free to grab me on the hallway if there's more. And I think we had good discussions underway. So thanks for your attention.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snia.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.